So we have a friend, or many friends in Australia. This is very good. Okay, so now we are moving to our last session. And I think what we will be dealing with brings together in a nutshell again the concepts which we have been discussing from yesterday morning on, which are after all the question of the common aims of civilization and the hope for the future, the last chance for humanity. So what we will hear now is from Hussein Askari. Please, Hussein, can you come here? On the situation, on the war danger. Then we will have the last panel on the question of the new renaissance of classical culture and science, which has to be the future paradigm. So I think these two very stark contrasts are really, you know, what everybody feels. And I think what also was getting across yesterday evening in the performance, especially of the Requiem, because this is exactly this question, whether we as a civilization will perish or whether we will be able to muster all our capabilities to go beyond whatever we thought we could do in front of unbelievable terror and dangers and really establish this beautiful idea of mankind, which we want to establish. So with that, Hussein.
Thank you very much. And hello again. As many of you might remember, last November, we were in this same place and Helget Seplarush presented an idea to how to deal with the danger of war in Southwest Asia and also with the terrible developments in Syria and the barbaric attack on actually not only on Syrian people but on a whole culture, a whole civilization from inside Syria, and also the threat of an attack on Iran. And so Helget Seplarush presented a concept for how to find a common goal for all nations to work together for, and I and some of my colleagues, we collaborated to elaborate what we could present as a solution and also as a goal to unite the nations of the region, but also to get international powers who are now they will end up in conflict, like the United States, the whole British Empire, in conflict with China and Russia will lead to a world war. This is the original idea, and then we had this discussion about how we could deal with the threat from the world deserts, which is an extension of deserts from Africa to Asia, which is a threat to societies, and also it's a threat to many societies, and also how to work both scientifically, politically, economically to limit the effect of the desert and eventually green the desert, and that this would be a planetary program where all nations can cooperate. So the details, of course, of this are in the previous conference. I'm not going to go through them. I want just to show you what progress has been done. Just to be forewarned that this project cannot be implemented today as it is. It's impossible right now to finance any infrastructure project or industrial project of this magnitude or even any other magnitude because of the present financial and economic system. So the first prerequisite would be to eliminate the current financial system by what Lyndon LaRouche said, solving the mystery of money with the Glass-Steagall. And that is the first the requirement. The second requirement is that the question of peace to stop all these wars, that the nations of the region cannot stop these wars. There's nothing Syria can do other than defending itself to stop the war. Libya could not do anything to stop the invasion against Libya. Iraq could not do anything because there was an intention, there was a policy to invade Iraq. There was a policy which was not Saddam Hussein's intention. And it's the same thing for Gaddafi. There is also an intention to attack Iran. Iran cannot do anything to stop an attack on Iran or a war, other than trying to defend themselves. And it reminds me of the story of a young man who was overrun by a car, and his father went to the prison to meet the driver, and to say why he did that. And the driver said, "Well, I tried to warn your kid. I honked for him. I sent a signal with the light. I waved for him, but he could not get out of the way." So he went to the hospital and he told his son, "The driver says he did all these things to get you out of the way." And the boy said, "Well, I know he did these things, But where, how can I get out of the way? I was sitting in the restaurant. So these nations are sitting there. They can't get out of the way for a war. So anyway, we have been having discussions with the actually government representatives in the region, with experts, with the organizations, you know, to bring this idea into the forum of discussions when people try to talk about solving political problems, because we cannot have peace without economic development. And that this should be included in every peace initiative. And I would also, it's very important that Russia, China, other nations who discuss with the United States or Europe, any discussion about peace in Southwest Asia should include and must include a perspective for improving the living conditions of the population. So in the process of getting that, I have a message will show after my presentation from an Iraqi official. So we have been getting in contact with many officials and experts on water and desertification and so on. So, I mean, it's these things, of course, as I said, we have to have a new economic order. We have to stop the war policy, as Lynn and Sarah said, by impeaching Obama. But we cannot wait for the future. You know, like people wait for a bus to come and get on the bus. We have to build the bus. We have to prepare the future. So in that process, the first qualitative response we got from Helga's and my presentation, and that we had actually a campaign, was the first qualitative response was from the Iranian government. Helga and I were invited in March to a conference organized by the Iranian Foreign Ministry's International Center for Political Studies, and to present these ideas and to present what we think. The conference was about the security of the Persian Gulf after the Arab Spring and revolutions and what implications that have. So unfortunately Helga could not attend the conference. I attended the conference, but Helga's paper was published in the conference with the conference papers. So the problem with the conference, that all the discussions, which reflects the danger in the region, all the discussions were about the threat of the sectarian war, the geopolitics, you know, and the Shia Sunni, and all these horrible things that take place. So it is true that people are living inside that hell right now, and they, of course, it's difficult for them to see a solution other than trying to survive and maneuver within that situation. But I had the chance to speak and present our idea, but I actually started by bringing up the meteorite explosion over Chelyabinsk to the audience and to get their attention. But then when I presented the perspective for greening the deserts and the Eurasian land bridge as the Schiller Institute peace plan, people were completely, you know, there was a change in their mind, because, you know, people are down there looking at the horrors of war, but then you bring them to a higher platform to see the world from a different viewpoint, then the mind opens up and say, well, great, why didn't we think about that ourselves? So I think this is the impact of getting these kind of ideas and get out of the smaller issues and get into the global planetary aspect of it. This conference was organized not in Tehran in the capital, but in Bandar Abbas, which is a city. This is the governor of Hormuzgan. I have an interview with him. It's in the EIR and a report from the conference. The Hormuzgan is the province which controls, this is where Bandar Abbas is on our Eurasian land bridge. And it also controls the islands which lay on the Hormuz Strait, the very important Hormuz Strait. There was this discussion yesterday about the flow of oil from there. The Gulf stands for 40%, the Persian Gulf. People call it the Arab Gulf on the Arab side. The Iranians call it the Persian Gulf. But 40% of all oil exports from the Gulf to the international markets go through the Hormuz Strait. 90%, as I said yesterday, go to primarily China, Japan, South Korea, India. Japan increased its import of oil as a way of diversifying there, because this is the easiest and quickest way to get more energy after Fukushima, to import more oil from the Gulf. So they're getting more dependent on that. And it's in that narrow area where all this is taking place. This is the direction of shipping. It's 50 kilometers all the way from there in the strait. And also you can, you know, I visited these islands on the Iranian side. But you can see that this is one of the most important and most sensitive areas in world, you know, in navigation in the world and transport in the world. But also, it also can become one of the most terrible places on Earth. I mean, when American aircraft carriers pass by there, people can see them from the Iranian side. And I think somebody was telling me that there might be a hotline between American and Iranian military, or indirect hotline, to avoid that an accident could lead to a major outbreak of, you know, of fire. And that would could lead to an outbreak of war. So this is the Hormuz Strait is very, very important. And it has the potential of creating, because you have in these three islands, the Greater Tomb, the Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa, these are contested by Iran and the United Arab Emirates. The Emirates claim that these belong to them, and the Iranians have sovereignty there. This was a British game. In 1971, when the British left, they handed over the place, or not handed over, but they let the Shah of Iran take over these islands. And now the British are encouraging the United Arab Emirates to take it back. So the Hormuz Strait has the potential of becoming a major breakout point for war. Now, Hormuzgan and that Iranian province is one of the fastest growing provinces in Iran, because in as was in the map there, that they have, the Iranian government have built a railway which extends from northern Iran to Bandar Abbas, and they built this port, Shahid Rajai container ship port. It's one of a very, very large port. And now many nations in Central Asia are totally dependent on cargo and trade going from Bandar Abbas, coming from Asia and elsewhere, to the landlocked countries in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. So this has become one of the most vital trade routes between the Indian Ocean region and Central Asia. Now, the Iranians, we can call this the Silk Road strategy. The Iranians have been, in spite of all economic sanctions, threats, and so on, they have been very consistent on building infrastructure projects which have a continental, transcontinental significance. In 1996, they built this small section here to connect to the old Soviet railway system and to China. China had simultaneously built a connection to Kazakhstan, so the old Silk Road was rebuilt. And later Iran built this connection to Turkey, so Europe and Asia were connected through this. Now they are building, this was built in 2004, and then there is the North-South Corridor, which goes from Russia to India. There's an agreement between Russia, Iran, and India to build a trade route through the Caucasus, through the Iranian railway network, and this is being built right now to Chabahar on the Arabian Sea. India is very interested in this because shipping by sea, it takes about 3 weeks to the Black Sea, while with the railway system to Russia, it takes 1 week. So this is an enormous change. So anyway, the Iranian strategy has been to position themselves in an economic way, in a peaceful economic way, to make other nations dependent on them for their trade and livelihood. And this is a very good strategic defense method. They're also building gas pipelines to Turkey, and they have just built a gas pipeline to Pakistan, which is very important to get Pakistan on board to solve the problem in Afghanistan and leave the Anglo-Saudi party, which is destabilizing Iran, by creating economic cooperation. So this is part of the general idea of getting an economic. And most of the Iranian officials in the conference, actually, they were speaking about getting an agreement in the Gulf, among all the Gulf countries, a peace agreement based on economic cooperation and also cultural cooperation. So they all realize now that the way to get out of this is not religious agreements, it's not strategic or geopolitical agreements, but economic dependency among nations. And I want to talk just about the sanctions. You pay attention not to the gentleman in the picture, but to these ships there. This is I was going to the Hormuz Island by ferry, and then there are many, many ships in the sea just standing there. And there was a man sitting next to me from the customs, and he said, these ships, they are not there waiting for something. They are just parked there because of the economic sanctions. And he said, Iran's 2,000-kilometer coast, there are about 5,000 major ships standing still because of the economic sanctions. Because Iranian Central Bank cannot have contact with international banks, and the ships cannot get these letters of credit. They cannot get insurance. So this is an enormous loss for Iran, but also an enormous loss for world trade. So this is in Iran, in spite of that, the Iranians are building, the Iranians are hit hard by the sanctions. The Iranian currency have gone down 300% against the dollar. Capital is flying from the country. Young people are trying also find ways to go out of the country to find a job and a future. So, but in spite of that, the Iranians are trying with the little resources they have to do something for their country to, you know, with the hope that there will be peace, that their country will be able to continue its economic development. All right, I just wanted to show you the insanity of the current economic system. On the other side of the Gulf, we have, like, this is Dubai. These are the allies of the British. And it's beside being one of the large drug money laundering centers in the world, it's also the shopping capital of the world. But it's a very completely arid country. And this is not built by the rich Arabs. This was one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in modern history, because Dubai, they don't have much resources. Abu Dhabi has the resources, the neighboring city. But in order to build these things, they were selling future projects to investors on brochures. So this is one of their ideas. Instead of greening the desert, they offer people to build artificial islands in the sea for tourists, nightclubs, shopping centers, and so on and so forth. And this was, you know, you have all these fancy things. By dredging the sand and building artificial islands, actually the environmentalist movement said nothing about this because they were burying all the corals on the side, but the environmentalists didn't say anything about it. But this is, for example, one of the projects they tried to sell in 2006, that you have artificial islands and you can buy a country and build whatever you want on that country. So this was sold in 2006. 70% of it was sold to international so-called developers, billionaires, and so on. But this was how the brochure looked like. And the company in Dubai, with the economic crisis hitting it, they were not able to finance anymore, and the real estate prices in Dubai collapsed in 2008, and then they were not able to get any new money for the future projects to finance the current projects. So this is how it ended up. It's sinking in the sea. There are only two islands which are built, and the rest. And there are more lawyers working to solve this than engineers, because all the people who bought the islands, they can't do anything. There's no infrastructure. And it's also destroying the waters of the Gulf. So there is one more thing in the Gulf we have, which is connected directly to the international financial system, is the so-called sovereign wealth funds. The Arab sovereign wealth funds, jointly, there's about $2 trillion. And this makes a lot of bankers and financiers in City of London and Wall Street drool over it. The one to the in the bottom is China, which is the largest one in the world, but the Chinese are using their capital in a wise way. They are not included in this. But I'm going to just mention, like here, the Arab countries were lured into supporting the financial bubble, but also in the bailout bubble. This is a list of the transactions which were made by these sovereign funds between 2007 and 2008. Like the Kuwait Investment Authority, they bought shares in the Citigroup, $12 billion. Citigroup also, Abu Dhabi, $7 billion. Merrill Lynch, Kuwait, $6 billion, and so on and so forth. So the oil money and all these things are going. I mentioned to our friend from Norway, the Norwegians have the same situation with their oil fund. And this is called the new global wealth machine. And this is a diagram which shows you where the money comes from and where it ends up. And it's all British and Wall Street banks. And then to the left you have the advisors. There are Lazard, you have all kinds of so-called advisory groups. And you have the lawyers on the right. And these are the people who are advising the Arab Gulf states on financial affairs and where to invest their money. And it's completely British controlled. It's either the city of London or Wall Street. And this is where the money went. These are financial transactions, $160 billion. This is since 2008. Real estate, $60 billion. Infrastructure and utilities. And this is not building new infrastructure and utilities like Dubai Ports Company. They buy ports that are already built in Europe or in the United States. They couldn't buy it in the United States for people in Congress. We're talking about national security and so on and so forth. And the bottom of the list, you have investments in healthcare. So this is where all the investments are going for. And the people who are advising these, as I said, this is the London School of Economics, Mark Thatcher, but this is not the infamous son of Margaret Thatcher, the arms dealer. This is another infamous Mark Thatcher who works in the London School of Economics. And it's an interesting study because he says Britain, the United Kingdom, are they get most investments from the Arab countries because they follow free trade. In the United States, they get very little money because they are more cautious about national security and allowing the Arabs to come into their system. But they, in spite of that, they did pay. So this is where how the show is run on the Arab side of the play. But you know, this is not the end of the road. Most of the money is gone, but to hell with the money. There is still, we have nations in the region. I mean, in Dubai, you still have one of the world's largest airports. You have the largest ports. You have Abu Dhabi. They are building 4 nuclear power plants with the help of South Korea. So you still have potential for development. And it's not that we are not talking to them. We are trying to talk to these governments on this side of the Gulf. But it's difficult to have a dialogue with Saudi Arabia, for example, when the national security chief is Prince Bandar bin Sultan. He will not allow anybody to talk to us. But and we have forewarned them before. This is Mr. Lyndon LaRouche in Abu Dhabi in 2002. Mr. LaRouche, in that visit, this was a very big conference on oil, the future of oil and international economy. This is the oil minister of the United Arab Emirates. And Mr. LaRouche was treated as a guest of honor. And actually, the United States, Britain, New Zealand, Canada, and Australia, all the ambassadors sent letters to the Zayed Center asking them to disinvite Mr. LaRouche, that he should not come to attend this conference. And they got even threats, but they didn't care about that. There were some interesting people there at the time. And Mr. LaRouche, he issued very strong warning to the people in the and there were people from Saudi Arabia, from all the Gulf countries, very important people. Very strong warning about the coming financial collapse. That was in 2002. And he said, we should get to the lifeboats. I remember LaRouche said that because I translated the speech. But he also, in a very friendly way, advised them on how to invest in their economy by focusing on nuclear power, focusing on petrochemicals instead of selling oil as raw material, greening the desert, water desalination, and building a real industrial economic base. Of course, they lost these years, and the whole region has lost these years, as Japan lost 10 years, as Europe is losing time. And we have been losing time, but the issue is that we still can go back there and have a totally new policy, but we have to have a new world economic order based on the principles which we discussed here, the Glass-Steagall, and to stop the war policy. When I was in Bandar Abbas, because if you stand somewhere, which is you see things from a different viewpoint, I think in this region, which I outlined, from Iran to Turkey to Iraq, Syria, the Gulf states, Egypt, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan, in this region, you have about 400 million people. And this is a very, very rich people. The population is very young. And actually, in many of these countries, the people are very well educated. But the current policy is not allowing, is killing this region and also killing the possibility for other nations to invest or to have this as a market for both capital goods and consumer goods. I mean, as I said, 90% of the oil in the Gulf goes to Asia. But in return, 80% of all imports, capital goods and consumer goods, also come from Asia. So Asia is actually totally dependent, not totally, but dependent to a large extent on trade with this region. But imagine if you develop this region in the correct way, which we are proposing. So you have 400 people with great resources and also a very strategic position between three continents. You can create an economic miracle in that region. So this is the thing. And also, you when you talk to people there and you see the children, you see, you know, people love life there. They love beauty. And I was standing in Bandar Abbas on the huge boulevard, and people in Iran, they love to have picnics, but usually they have picnics in the evening because it's hot there. And you see all these kids playing, and you look at the Hormuz Strait and the water, and you imagine that there is maybe an aircraft carrier next day. You know, it's totally horrendous. Thoughts came to my mind. But people there, they do want to live. They do want to have a future. In the flight from Tehran to Bandar Abbas, there was a young, and I will finish with this, there was a young Iranian man, I think he was 24, 25, sitting next to me, and he was studying a huge map of an electric device or machine. You know, and he was worried. It seems that he was going there on to work. And then, before we landed, he took it away and quickly took out the notebook, and he started writing things in Persian. I'm not good in Persian. I can manage, but he was looking out through the window, and then he was writing something and smiling. And then I, from the shape of the lines, I realized that he was writing a poem. And he was smiling and looking through the window and then writing things. So, you know, it really moved me to see that those young people, I mean, it's not only, and this is where the issue of culture is coming in here. Because it's not, you know, it's not material things we are talking about. We are talking about uplifting the human soul. And I think the ingredients are there, both in Iran and in Iraq and in the Arab world. We do have the Renaissance, which we are grateful for the Greeks and Plato to have. But we have the ingredients for progress, for a cultural renaissance in the region. But the problem is that we don't have a just world economic order. And I think this is the challenge we just presented today, and we have to all work for that end. Thank you very much. I have a video of Dr. Hassan Janabi. He's Iraq's ambassador to the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. He couldn't come to the conference, but he simultaneously, as we had the previous conference, he had written a letter to the Iraqi government, an open letter, to build the Green Belt, which I had presented also in the conference. But we did it simultaneously and without knowing each other. So it was not because of our work. But then when I contacted him, he studied our proposals, and he wanted to comment on them. By the way, Dr. Hassan Janabi is an expert on water systems and desertification.
Water and food are interconnected, and if there is proper access to water, then you would expect the food production to be high, and poverty level would be lower. The area, particularly the Tigris-Euphrates River basin in West Asia, used to have plenty of water that historically used to flow to the Gulf. Through Iraq. However, starting in the 70s, major infrastructure have been constructed in the upper reaches of the river basin, particularly in Turkey, Syria, and of course in Iraq as well. What is particular on this is all these major infrastructures have been established without proper agreement between the current countries, all based on unilateral action. And this is unfortunate in the Middle East, where politics also is very, very high. So with the over-control on water, of course, the food and agriculture production became an issue. When it comes to investment, in my view, the reasonable investment have been done in the river basins in Western Asia, particularly in the Euphrates and Tigris River, but this has been only invested in building infrastructure. So, and those infrastructure have major environmental impacts. So the environment was a victim of these major investment. Unfortunately, desertification is a process that is that's also linked to the availability of water. There is water, so there is a green cover, there are trees, production, agriculture, and what have you. So desertification is the process where the natural processes could be mitigated. The natural processes causes of desertification could be mitigated, and the man-made causes of desertification could be absolutely eliminated if a constructed efforts taking place where programs are orchestrated between the neighboring countries, because it is not only national and regional phenomenon, but it's also global phenomenon. But I suggest Iraq, of course, has been fallen victim of major desertification expansion coming from the western part of Iraq. What has been suggested is to build a major green belt to stop basically the expansion of the desert into that historically fertile soil of the Mesopotamian land, which is at the western part of the Euphrates River. So this is what I'm suggesting is not only a reforestation a project where millions of trees, more than 200 million of trees, would be planted, but it's also a major development project where environmental friendly technologies have to be used, human settlement, engagement of the communities, because social conditions and social involvement in these projects are basically the ingredient for a successful desertification combating program in the country and in the area. So, but this is national initiative that needs to be supported and that needs to be expanded across the region. And so, involving the community, and what I'm saying in implementing this project, technology by itself and engineering is not the solution. It is part of the solution. The solution has to be much bigger than involving engineering and technology by basically involving the community, providing jobs, human settlement, a sense of responsibility, and sharing the benefit of that. So these are the ingredients for a major achievement in building this green national green belt in the Iraqi desert. Shilluk Institute initiative is a highly respected approach for the issues of environment, poverty reduction, where you promote ideas of you bring it together, economy, science, and human dignity. Actually, this is what needs to be promoted. This is the approach where government and communities are involved in improving living conditions for that particular region as well as other regions. It is a future-oriented, future-looking approach so that the communities, the countries, the nations of the area are not stuck only in the past. So this is a way forward to improve conditions in the area. Thank you.
All right. I just want to thank also our friends in Italy who helped us tape this interview. But also I would very much thank all the translators. Usually they are forgotten in these processes. They are doing an enormous job. I think we should give them an applause. These are my gang. I'm a former translator. We also thank the technicians.
Well, I have to add one thing to what you said, Hussein, that is, we should also convey greetings from Ayman Rashid from Egypt, the engineer who has been working on the Africa Pass project. He could not come this time, but he's very strongly working on it, and he sends his best greetings, and he also wrote up a message which we will publish on the Schiller Institute website, as all the other, the progress of what you described, I mean, this development programs and so on. So there's
He's actually today was invited to speak in a conference on water crisis in Egypt by the Egyptian water ministry, the government. So he's going to present his project and also our idea.